Psyched. It's Friday. Time to learn about, what do we do every Friday? CMB and Big Bang Nucleosynthesis, right? Okay, so cosmic microwave background and Big Bang Nucleosynthesis. One day, but in the opposite order, this one and then this one. Okay, so let's dive right in. No, sorry. Before we dive right in, I have to... I'll just start with a joke. This lecture obviously naturally breaks up into two jokes, so hopefully I'll actually remember to tell two. So two wise men are sitting over a table, looking into a staring silently into a cup of tea, and after a long silence, one of them says, "You know, life is like a cup of tea with sugar in it," and the other one says, "You know, how so?" First one says, "What am I, a philosopher?" Okay. Next, try again. What if I had said the final line? "I don't know. What am I, a philosopher?" Wouldn't have helped. Okay. Well, that's the joke. Okay. So let's do Big Bang Nucleosynthesis the way George Gamow would have done it. Figuring out the crucial point in 15 minutes of sketching on the back of an envelope. Okay, so to start with, let's just set the stage here. Let's just review sort of some of the energy scales that we think are in physics up at high energies. So the highest energies people talk about, you know, are sort of the Planck scale. This is basically 1 over the square root of g Newton in units where h bar and c are equal to 1. Okay, and so this is about 10 to the 19 GeV. Okay, so let's say this is energy scale here. That's 10 to the 19 GeV. Not too far below that, maybe about 3 orders of magnitude below that. There's a hypothesized GUT scale, grand unified scale, where the electroweak and strong forces are hypothesized to unify. Okay, and this also may be the scale. This is the scale at which arguably the simplest models of inflation take place at. That should be 10 to the 16. And then there's a huge gap where there's no consensus about what to even really hypothesize goes on in here. And then we get down to 10 to the 3, and that should be GUT, sorry, should be 10 to the 16 GeV is inflation or the GUT scale. And inflation could also be at lower energy scales. I don't want to say that it has to be at that scale, but we'll see the simplest models are up at this scale. Then 13 orders of magnitude lower, we have the electroweak scale, and another order of magnitude below that, we have sort of the electroweak. These is maybe sort of the scales that a few TeV here are what the LHC is currently probing, and then at 10 to the 2 GeV, we have sort of the weak gauge bosons, the W and Z bosons, the Higgs boson. And then another 2 orders of magnitude below that, 1 GeV. You know, those are the proton and neutron masses. And then another 3 orders of magnitude below that, 1 MeV. Those are sort of now we're getting into the range that we're talking about the energy gaps between the different energy states of nuclear transitions.
When you say the WC and H scale or the proton scale, what do you mean by this is the WC H scale? This is
the mass of the W boson, Z boson, and Higgs boson are all about 100 GeV. This is these are 80, and this guy's 120. And then by the proton and neutron, I mean their masses are both roughly one GeV. So then down here, one MeV, we're getting down to sort of the typical energy scales of nuclear physics. So, you know, if two protons and two neutrons bind together to form a helium atom, how much energy is released in that process? It's, you know, of order MeV. Or what is the mass difference between the proton and the neutron? It's of order an MeV. Okay, and then another six orders or five orders of magnitude below that, down at one or ten EV, those are the energy scales for atomic transitions. The binding energy of hydrogen is about 13.6 EV. Is 13.6 EV, and so this is the energy scale at which, so if you imagine the universe cooling down here, you know, various events happen as the temperature crosses through the appropriate energy scale here. At the end of the lecture, we'll be talking about the CMB. That takes place as the CMB photons are released as the universe cools below roughly 10 or 1 EV. Big Bang nucleosynthesis, as we'll see, takes place around this energy scale, about around nuclear energy scales. To sort of tell the story, let's not start up at tremendously speculatively high energy scales. Let's start up at maybe 10 GeV. Okay, so what was the universe like at 10 GeV? Well, for one thing, since 10 GeV is a factor of 10 higher than the masses of the protons and neutrons, the protons, those particles were still relativistic. So protons, antiprotons, neutrons, antineutrons, were still just relativistic fermions. They were essentially massless as far as thermodynamics was concerned. So each of these species had about the same abundance as the photon at that time. Okay, but then as the universe, so that's at 10 GeV. As the universe cooled below 1 GeV, suddenly these guys became non-relativistic, and thermodynamics wanted to suppress their number density. So up here, their number density was going like the number of protons and antiprotons and neutrons and antineutrons, the number density was some, you know, order one constant times t cubed. But down here, suddenly it wants to be like, thermodynamics wants it to be like e to the minus m proton over t, once we get below that energy scale. So what happens in practice is that, in this case, all the protons and antiprotons annihilate that can. Basically, every antiproton in the universe gets annihilated at that moment. And similarly, every antineutron in the universe at that moment gets annihilated. But not all of the protons and neutrons get annihilated there is a tiny smidgen of protons and neutrons left over after all the antimatter annihilates. Yeah? That's right.
What if it's exponentially suppressed? How do you know that all the antimatter disappeared? Was it just mostly
gone? So that's a good question. So in fact, like we discussed in the last lecture, eventually this process will freeze out. So in fact, there will be some residual antineutrons aren't stable, but antiprotons in the universe today from this epoch. But you can calculate how much it is, and it's an academically small amount. You'll never meet one. For all intents and purposes, after this annihilation takes place, there's only protons and neutrons left over. How do we know that? Well, there's still protons and neutrons in the universe today, and as far as we can tell, at least on Hubble timescales, at least on cosmological timescales, protons are stable. So the guys that were left over after this annihilation are the ones that are still around today. And so before the annihilation took place, these guys were all relativistic. They had the same number densities as the photon. On the other hand, as we'll see today, you can measure what the ratio, how many protons and neutrons, how many quote unquote baryons. These things are collectively called baryons. So every time you have a proton or a neutron, you say you have one baryon. You can measure how many baryons are in the universe today per photon. That ratio is commonly called eta, the baryon to photon ratio. Okay, so number of baryons, in other words, number of nucleons, N and P, per photon. That number is measured to be about 6 times 10 to the minus 10. Okay, so there's about, so in other words, what that is saying is that in the early universe here, if there had been equal numbers of protons and antiprotons and equal numbers of neutrons and antineutrons, they would have all annihilated away. There would be nothing in the universe today except for this incredibly small remaining residual freeze-out abundance. But fortunately for you and me, for every billion protons, there was a billion and one. For every billion antiprotons, there was a billion and one protons in the early universe. So the first billion annihilated, but one proton was left over. Okay, so that's what you and I are made of. Okay, so then once we get below this energy scale, what do we have left in the universe? We're gonna now talk about what's going on in the universe between 1 GeV and the next major energy scale, 1 MeV. Well, we have protons and neutrons. They're both non-relativistic now. We have electrons and positrons. They're both still relativistic. We have the neutrinos. They're still relativistic, and they're still coupled to the thermal bath. I don't know why I wrote that as eta. What I mean is we have neutrinos, nu. And then we have the photon. Okay, those are the particles that are still around. So what do they do? They're all initially here in thermal equilibrium. And so what I want to calculate for you is that as we get toward the lower, they're in thermal equilibrium, but because the neutron is a little bit heavier than the proton, we want to see that thermal equilibrium dictates that its abundance gets more and more suppressed relative to the proton abundance as the temperature comes down. And then suddenly, at around here, it becomes thermodynamically favorable for all of those protons and neutrons to bind up into nuclei. So basically, all of the neutrons want to get bound into the deepest nuclear potential that they can easily get into, which is the helium nucleus. So every two neutrons grab two protons, become a helium atom. The remaining protons are just hydrogen. And so we're going to calculate at the end of that process what is the ratio of helium to hydrogen, or what is the ratio of helium? Yeah, what's the ratio of helium to hydrogen? And see that a back of the envelope calculation sees that it can turn out to be roughly the cosmological abundance, which is better than what you do in stars. You cannot get that answer from cooking helium in the centers of stars. So it was the first bit of evidence that that these light elements were really formed in the Big Bang. And then once you have that sort of pat on the back from a back of the envelope calculation, you can go through, which we won't do, you can go through and do a more detailed calculate. You can write a computer code to follow the reaction rates in more detail and calculate, you know, all the different abundances for all the light isotopes, and then go compare those to observations. And so we now know that this is basically certainly correct, that the first four elements in the periodic table and their various isotopes were formed in this way. Okay, so how does the thermodynamic calculation go? Well, it's a little bit similar to you saw a similar problem. Yesterday in the tutorial, so I'll just be brief here. So you know the main reaction going on at low energies that allows neutrons and protons to come in and out of existence are reactions of the form, well, you have to conserve baryon number and lepton number in charge. So the reactions you're allowed to have here are you can have a proton plus an electron, so that has one baryon number and one lepton number and zero charge. So I have to write down something similar on this side of the equation. So and the answer is I can write down this guy. That conserves all charges. And then any crossing, you know, I'm allowed to cross this in any way I want. So I can bring a guy across as long as I replace it by its antiparticle. So P plus E minus plus the anti-electron neutrino goes to the neutron. You know, that's an example of another allowed reaction. But all of these reactions ultimately are described by the same Feynman diagram, which back in the 40s and 50s would have been described by Fermi theory. It would have been described by a Feynman rule that Fermi said four fermions could interact, and when they did, their interaction rate was given by the coupling constant G Fermi, which he said was measured to be about 10 to the minus 5 giga electron volts to the minus 2. So you know, nowadays we would say that what this reaction is so this, you know, let's say this is proton. Proton comes in, neutron comes out, electron comes in, electron neutrino comes out. Nowadays, we would say, well, we wouldn't really describe it by this four fermion interaction. We would say the real diagram here looks something like, you know, in the actual standard model, looks something like electron comes in, neutrino comes out, they emit a W boson, and then up quark comes in, down quark comes out, and then another up goes along for the ride, and another down goes along for the ride. These guys are a proton. These three guys make a neutron. So anyway, so the, you know, if you just estimate the amplitude here, well, there's a factor of G weak, the weak coupling constant here and here. And then there's the propagator for the W boson, which is something like 1 over P squared minus the W boson mass squared.
Sorry, would you mind writing that?
Sorry, yes, I would not mind. So we're trying to estimate the amplitude for, it's not even much larger. We're trying to estimate the amplitude for this diagram. And we're saying it's roughly, well, you get a coupling constant here and here. You get the propagator for the one internal line. But you know, this is at such low energies, these guys are, we're imagining this taking place down at 1 MeV energies, much energy scales much below the 100 GeV mass of the weak boson. So this, the exchange momentum here is pathetically small. We can ignore it. And so then if you just plug in numbers here, you know, okay, this is some fraction of 1, you know, 0.2 or something like that squared. So we'll take that to be about 1/10. And this is 1 over 100 GeV squared. Okay, so that's... So the whole thing is just basically roughly a constant in the limit that we can ignore this p squared, and that constant is exactly the size of Fermi's constant. That's where Fermi's constant comes from. So the amplitude, in any case, is of order G Fermi, and then we want to actually calculate when this reaction freezes out. We want to calculate when gamma is approximately equal, when the rate per particle of this reaction is approximately equal to the Hubble rate. So we say, well, the rate we know it's going to go is the amplitude squared. That's just quantum mechanics. And then we have to do some complicated phase space integral to get the actual rate. But as you already argued yesterday in class, just by dimensional analysis, gamma has to have units, the rate per particle has to have units of mass. This guy has units of 1 over mass to the fourth, so we need to pick the largest energy scale that could be characterizing the phase space here and plug that in with the right power. So that's T to the fifth. Hopefully you guys thought about that argument yesterday in class. So we have our expression for gamma. On the other hand, for H, we use the Friedman equation, 8 pi g over 3 rho, Well, G we can write as 1 over the Planck mass squared. Rho, we saw that for a relativistic gas, the energy density is basically the number of relativistic degrees of freedom, which in this case, you know, these are all the particles available, and some of them aren't even relativistic. So it's some number of order 10 times pi squared over 30 times the temperature to the fourth. Okay, and hopefully you guys had a chance to do the exercise. If you just take the square root of this, if you just take the square root of this expression, so h is equal to the square root of this thing, you set that equal to this expression for gamma, and solve, you just find a solution for T. You know, these are all known quantities. That's 10 to the 19 GeV. That's some number, it's about 10. So the only thing that's unknown here is T. You solve for it, you find that it's about 1 MeV. Okay, and so now to be so at that moment, let's ask what the ratio of neutrons to protons was. So again, the result we quoted in lecture last time, and that you're deriving on the problem set, the result that's in lecture notes number 7 for a non-relativistic species in thermal equilibrium, is that its number density is about its mass times the temperature over 2 pi to the 3 halves times exponential of minus its mass over T. So the number density of protons over the number density of neutrons over the number density of protons is, well, this factor just cancels between the two of them. They have basically the same mass. Their mass difference is only, they have a little mass difference that's going to matter over here, but so we take the ratio of this factor between the two expressions, so we get a factor of m neutron over m proton to the 3 halves. That's going to be irrelevant. But then when we take the ratio of the exponentials, we get a factor of minus m neutron minus m proton, the difference between their masses over T. And so we want to calculate what was this ratio at the moment of freeze-out. Again, this is basically 1, so let's just ignore that factor. M neutron minus m proton is 1.3 MeV. T we just calculated is about about 1 MeV. A more accurate calculation would show that freeze-out actually takes place at 0.8 MeV. Okay, so we have 1.3 MeV over 0.8 MeV. This is about 1/6. Okay, so at the moment when neutrons and protons fall out of equilibrium, at the moment when the reaction the reactions that would set their number densities fail to be efficient, the number of neutrons per proton is about 1/6. Now, you have to wait a little while longer before it's thermodynamically favorable for those neutrons and protons to actually bind together into helium atoms, but not much longer. In the meantime, just take my word for it, the neutron, you know, the proton is stable, but a free neutron just floating around is not stable. It wants to decay. It decays with a lifetime of about 15 minutes. So while these guys are waiting around to bind into helium, some of the neutrons decay, and this ratio of 1/6, just to get the answer to turn out nice, I will just quote for you that it decays to 1/7. And so now we just have to calculate. Okay, so now at this point, once it's decayed to a factor of 1/7, suddenly they're ready. Suddenly it becomes thermodynamically favorable for them to bind into nuclei. So basically, again, the deepest nuclear potential that's easily accessible to these guys is the helium guy, is the helium nucleus, the helium 4 nucleus. So all the neutrons just love to get bound up into helium nuclei as soon as the temperature gets low enough. So basically, a helium nucleus has two neutrons plus two protons. So basically, if we calculate the number density of helium atoms, it's going to be half the number density of neutrons. We imagine basically every neutron gets soaked up by a helium atom. Okay, so the number density of helium is going to be the number density of neutrons, I should say, divided by 2. And n sub n is the number density of neutrons. And then if we divide that by the total number of neutrons plus protons, okay, this is the fraction of the universe, the fraction of the mass in the universe that's in helium. This is the number density of helium atoms to the total number density of nucleons. I have this thing where every time I mean to say neutron, I say nucleon, and vice versa. So I don't know what to say about that. I apparently can't correct it. So now if we want to calculate the mass fraction, how much of the mass of the universe goes into helium relative to the total mass? Well, to get the total mass of the universe, we take the total number of protons and neutrons, and we multiply them by one proton mass. To get the total mass of helium, we take the number density of helium atoms and multiply it by 4 times the proton mass, I mean four nucleon masses. Okay, approximately. So those guys cancel. So now if you just simplify here, if we just divide by n proton in the numerator and the denominator, we have 4 times n neutron over n proton, so that's 1/7, we said. That's our guy, 1/7. Divided by 2 over, divide this by, okay. Is it clear what I did here? I divided by the number of protons in the numerator and the denominator. So this guy becomes 1, this guy becomes 1/7, this guy becomes 1. And if you just evaluate this, it's equal to 1/4, which is the observed mass ratio of helium to the total mass of baryons in the universe. Okay, this is the observed fact that the mass of helium accounts for about 75% of the mass in the universe, or the mass of ordinary atoms in the periodic table in the universe, and the mass of hydrogen accounts for about. Okay, and now the point of this was not to get a precise answer. The point again is just to see that this idea is in the ballpark. It looks like it could be on the right track. Then you go back and you write a more sophisticated computer code to follow all the rates in more detail as the universe cools. Again, you calculate for all of the lightest four elements and their isotopes, the abundances. You compare to observations. The answer is true. The answer is that it works. It clearly works. There is one important discrepancy to mention. The abundance of the lithium-7, the isotope of lithium with 7 nucleons. If you go and look in the spectrum of the youngest stars you can find and look for the lithium abundance there, that's our best proxy for the primordial abundance of lithium. You find that it's about a factor of 3, the observed abundance over the predicted abundance. Is about a third. It's pretty far off. So it's not 100% clear at the moment whether this is indicating something, some genuine clue about fundamental physics in the early universe, or probably more likely it's just saying that when we look at the envelopes of early stars, of quote-unquote low metallicity stars, probably we're fooling ourselves when we think we're measuring the primordial abundance. There are a lot of astrophysical complications that you that could be messing up the agreement. But maybe that's not the answer, so it's something at least to be aware of. I think that's all I wanted to say about Big Bang Nucleosynthesis. It's a good idea to have. I recommend everyone have an idea like that.
So in the when you compute the number, density number for the nucleus that you're assuming that all the neutrons go into nucleus, so there's no free neutrons.
That's right.
The rest of the mass is protons.
That's right. So the idea is you have a bunch of neutrons and a bunch of protons. When it becomes as soon as the temperature gets low enough, you know, four neutrons, the mass of two neutrons and two protons is significantly bigger. It's bigger by a couple of MeV than the mass of the corresponding helium atom that they form. So as soon as the temperature gets low enough, it's energetically favorable for these guys to bind up like this. The only reason they don't bind up earlier in the universe's history is that when the temperature is high enough, it's not entropically favorable. But as soon as the temperature lowers enough, thermodynamics wants this guy to go this way. But because there's more protons than neutrons, when all of the neutrons and when as many neutrons and protons find each other as possible, there's leftover protons instead of being leftover neutrons. So then protons are stable. So after the process, what you get is just a bunch of helium 4 atoms, and then the leftover hydrogen, which is about 75% of the mass. And then, you know, in more detail, there are trace amounts of the other elements. The other elements are produced in much lower abundances. You know, less than 1%. Of the mass goes into those guys.
You're assuming that the only two elements we can form is helium.
The only ones that get formed in significant abundances are helium-4 and hydrogen. But then deuterium, like the weight 2 isotope of hydrogen, gets formed in a little trace amount. Helium-3, lithium-6 and 7. Everything gets formed. All these light guys get formed in trace amounts. And then you can check, for several of those, you can check observationally that the observed amounts are equal to those trace amounts. Especially deuterium, that's maybe the most important one, turns out, observationally. Okay. Is there anything else? No, that's it. I just wanted to say, you know, one other thing is that we mentioned this in passing, but this fact that there were 1,000,000,001 protons for every billion antiprotons, 1,000,000,001 particles of matter for every billion particles of antimatter. You know, that's like a basic fact about the universe that remains to be explained. There's no great theory for where that number comes from. So that's the problem of explaining the matter-antimatter asymmetry. Why is the universe filled with matter today and rather than antimatter, and why in precisely the abundance that it has? We'll see later, but that probably... the modern interpretation is that probably is a hint about fundamental physics at high energies that just doesn't have, there's various proposed candidate interpretations, but we just don't know which one is right yet. Or we don't know if we have found the right one yet. Okay, so before embarking on the CMB, joke number 2. So the two wise men who we met in the previous joke, and who by now are beloved to you, they are talking again. And one of them says, you know, wise man number 2, tell me, why is it that when I throw buttered toast, let it fall to the ground, it always lands butter side up? And wise man number 1 says, very simple. And he butters some toast and he drops it, and it lands butter side down. And he says, the answer is, it's just not true. And wise man number 2 says, but you buttered the wrong side. It's like a pretty good joke for a theoretical physics institute, I think. You don't think it's appropriate for this class? There's a lot of, like, Okay. You're going to rebel. Soon you're going to rebel. Again, the ideal thing would be if one of you guys had a joke. I know you know jokes. I know you have heard jokes other than in this class. Ideally, one of you would strike up the courage to come up here and really tell a joke that makes people laugh. Anybody? Anybody? I'm looking you all in the eyes to make you uncomfortable. No? Okay. You have strength in numbers. Okay, the cosmic microwave background. We have 20 minutes. Okay. I was actually thinking of doing this anyway, and now that we only have 20 minutes, I'm definitely going to do it. So we're going to tell the story of the cosmic microwave background, but the actual calculation of when it is released, at what point in the universe and at what temperature, that'll be one of the homework problems. So let's just say what happens. So the universe is cooling down, like we said. It's cooling down. It cooled down past 1 MeV, and the light nuclei were formed. The helium in the universe was formed. Now it's cooling. Now it gets down to the energy scale corresponding to atomic transitions. Atomic transitions have typical energy scales of order 1 eV. The binding energy of hydrogen is 13.6 eV. So what happens? So prior to this epoch, even though it is energetically favorable for protons and electrons to bind into hydrogen atoms, just like it's energetically favorable for neutrons and protons to bind into helium atoms, when the temperature is too hot relative to the binding energy, they don't want to do it. It's entropically disfavored. The free energy, the Helmholtz free energy of that transition, the Helmholtz free energy of the system is minimized when they're stripped apart. So in the early universe, we have tons of protons and tons of electrons, and they're not bound to each other. And in that state, that's a so-called plasma. Plasma just means a gas of charged particles, right, as opposed to a gas of neutral particles. So in a plasma, the photons are going crazy. They bump into everything in sight. They love to bump into charged particles, and they're moving on. They have very short mean free paths, and so they're just random walking around, bumping into the different charged particles, not getting anywhere. Then, as you will calculate, when the temperature gets down to about 0.3 eV, suddenly these guys all want to bind into hydrogen atoms, okay, neutral hydrogen atoms. And at that point, those particles just begin to stream off through the universe. So again, it'll just be a good exercise. It's a calculation. It's quite parallel to the one that we did for Big Bang nucleosynthesis that will let you calculate that this is the temperature that the universe was when this transition took place. After that moment, the photons had nothing to bump into. They just went streaming off through the universe. About 90% of them never bumped into anything again, and never will bump into anything again. So when we collect some of those photons in our telescopes today, you know, we're quite literally looking at a snapshot of that the universe took of itself at this moment in time. Now, another thing you'll calculate on the homework is roughly when was this moment of time, and you'll see that it's about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. Okay. By contrast, this earlier epoch of Big Bang nucleosynthesis was about what kind of took place, the action took place between about 1 second and 3 minutes after the Big Bang. Okay? So that's really the first direct moment where we have an observational relic today that we can pin to a particular moment after the Big Bang and say we have evidence that the Big Bang theory was correct at that moment. So Big Bang nucleosynthesis tells us we know what we were doing at about 1 second to a few minutes after the Big Bang. The cosmic microwave background tells us that we know what we were doing a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang. Now, as we'll see next week, the detailed perturbations in the cosmic microwave background, the fluctuations from point to point on the sky, and the statistics of those fluctuations, it is believed that those were laid down far earlier even than Big Bang nucleosynthesis. It's believed that those were laid down in the first tiny, tiny fraction of a second when the energy density of the universe was very high, maybe as high as the gut scale, by the simplest models, if the simplest models of inflation are correct. So the CMB is also contains information that probably is giving us a direct handle on ultra early timescales, but we can't pin down exactly what those ultra early timescales were at the moment. Although there's a satellite that's releasing data later this month that ideally would change that story, but we'll have to see about that. But in any case, so the CMB may be telling us, very likely is telling us about ultra early times, much earlier than 1 second after the Big Bang. But the actual event itself, the actual CMB photons were released a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang. So as I say, you'll calculate these guys on the homework. I just wanted to end with to show you sort of three classic images that have to do three classic images about the CMB that you really should go home knowing about. There are three things that you your life will not be complete if you don't understand what these three slides say. These are really three of the key things about the universe. Third joke, maybe? Well, I gotta save my. I don't actually have an infinite supply, so I have to conserve. Okay, so this is plot number one. So in 1992, the first satellite, NASA launched the first satellite that specifically look at the CMB, called the COBE satellite. And one of the things that it had, one of the instruments that it had on it was the so-called FIREASS instrument. It looked at the intensity as a function of frequency. So you know it had scanned through different frequency bins, and at each narrow little frequency bin, it said, you know, how bright is the cosmic microwave background at that frequency? And so the green curve is the perfect thermal Planck distribution for a gas in thermal equilibrium, for the photons emitted by a gas in thermal equilibrium at a temperature of 2.7 Kelvin, and the red points are the data points from the FIREASS instrument, except that I forget the exact number, but you know, actually these error bars have been blown up by a factor of like 1,000 to make them visible. So it got these, so the actual instrument, in fact, you should imagine all of these error bars being shrunk down by a factor of 1,000. They lie perfectly on this Planck, on this Planckian distribution. So the CMB is like the most perfect black body, perfect thermal distribution that we've ever observed. It's like perfect. Okay? That's important thing number one to know about the CMB. Okay? Really, that's important. So there's this bath of radiation out there. We discovered it, and then it turned out to be absolutely a perfect black body. Okay, so then subsequent to that, a variety of satellites have been making better and better maps of the CMB across the sky. Okay, so what is this picture showing? So I showed you that the FIREASS instrument got a perfect black body distribution, sort of, but it didn't look at any particular direction on the sky. That was just the average signal measured by FIREASS. But in fact, if you look more closely, what you find is that if you point your telescope in this direction and measure the spectrum, okay, you might get this curve. But then if you point it at some different point on the sky, you'll get a slightly different curve. Okay, you'll get another exact black body spectrum in that other direction. but with a slightly lower temperature. And then in some other direction on the sky, you'll get another, if you take the spectrum just pointing your telescope in this direction, you'll get another spectrum. It'll be exactly a black body, but at a slightly higher temperature. Okay, and the fluctuations here are very exaggerated on my figure. In fact, every direction you point at, not only is it a perfect black body, but the temperature is the same in every direction you look to a part in 100,000. But then at a part in 100,000, and with fluctuations of order 10 to the minus 5, you get this. You begin to see that there's actually slightly different temperatures in different directions. Okay, so here they've just subtracted out the uniform part, and they're just plotting the 10 to the minus 5 fluctuations. So this is just like you would take a map of the globe and plot it in 2D as a plot it on a flat surface as an oval. This is the same thing, but it's just a map of the celestial sphere around us, and then you see the distribution of spots that are 10 to the minus 5 colder, 10 to the minus 5 hotter, and so on. Okay, so this turns out to be our most, like, this is the most important treasure trove of data that the universe has bequeathed to us. Okay, the detailed statistics of these fluctuations turn out to tell you some very sharp things about the early universe, probably things that were the best theory of where those things come from has them happening at some stupendously, has them being generated at some stupendously high energy scale, like 10 to the 16 GeV, the gut scale, 13 orders of magnitude above what the Large Hadron Collider can access, a tiny, tiny fraction of 1 second after the Big Bang. Okay? And so the main statistic that you will see, the first statistic to be extracted, and still at the moment the most important thing that we've extracted about the statistics of the CMB is the so-called temperature power spectrum. Okay, so that's what's shown here. So what are we actually looking at here? So as I say, this satellite, this is the most recent figure. This is basically the final map that came from the WMAP satellite. The WMAP satellite is a satellite that was launched around the year 2000. Now, it turns out there's another satellite called the Planck satellite, an improvement on the WMAP satellite, and everybody has been waiting for its new improved maps, which actually, as it happens, will come out later this month. But for now, this is still the best plot we have. Okay, and so again, what is this really showing? Well, it's showing the temperature in different directions on the sky. So as a function of the angles, if you put spherical coordinates on the celestial sphere, theta and phi, it's showing, well, there's the average temperature, this 2.7 degrees Kelvin, 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. That's just subtracted out. But then there's a fluctuation, an order 10 to the minus 5 fluctuation. The temperature is really different at different points on the sky. So if we take this fluctuation, if you take a function in Euclidean space, it's natural to decompose it into its Fourier components. Well, on a sphere, the natural thing to decompose into are the spherical harmonics, which you're probably familiar with from like the wave functions for the hydrogen atom and so forth. So you take this function, t of theta and phi, and just decompose it into its spherical harmonics. Okay, so I remind you, the spherical harmonics are these functions. They're kind of the natural orthonormal functions on the sphere. And they're labeled by just like orbital angular momenta are. They're labeled by one index L, which takes on values 0, 1, dot 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 up to infinity, and an index M, which runs from minus L to L in integer values. So it takes on 2L plus, for a fixed L, M takes on 2L plus 1 values between minus L and L. So we decompose this function into a sum, that was a terrible sum, into a sum from L equals 0 to infinity and M equals minus L to L of some coefficients, ALM, times these spherical harmonics. And then if you just take, and then you define, if you just take all the ALMs, you take this map, you do this, you decompose it in this way into spherical harmonics, and then at a fixed L, you take all the ALMs and you just average their squares. Okay, so you take the sum from M equals minus L to L of the absolute value of ALM squared, and you average, you just divide by the number of terms in the sum. That is CL. And then what they're just plotting here is, so they take this map, they extract the ALMs, they calculate CL, and then just for plotting purposes, they multiply it here by L times L plus 1, because it happens to make the peaks look a little bit clearer. So they plot it, and they get this figure. And so this figure, again, first of all, it's... So this curve here, I don't know, it might be a little bit hard to... Can you guys see this curve even? Or is it kind of hard to see? There's a curve running through the middle of those data points. Again, that is a theoretically predicted curve that's telling us basically for a certain very simple spectrum of perturbations in the early universe, initial conditions, if you want. There are tiny little density fluctuations in the early universe, and then you just put those in. They have some very simple form we'll discuss next week, and then you just let physics evolve those perturbations forward until the moment when the CMB photons were released. And ask how much have they grown, and what perturbations do they induce in the CMB temperature from point to point in the sky. You get this predicted curve. The data points clearly are doing exactly what the predicted curve predicts here. And in particular, the most striking feature is that they're exhibiting these peaks and valleys. So let's just in 1 minute, give a cartoon picture of what those peaks and valleys are. Why are there peaks and valleys in the spectrum? So the idea is that, the idea in short is that so rather than considering this full noisy function, okay, it's better to think one mode at a time. It's just like if you have a noisy spectrum, usually what you'll do is decompose it into its Fourier modes and just think about one Fourier mode at a time. So it's fruitful to do the same thing here. So in the early universe, so we think again, this is something that we'll be discussing more next week, but we think that in addition to the ordinary matter in the periodic table, in order to account for this graph, you need to hypothesize that there is also, in order to account for this figure, but also many other things in cosmology, you need to hypothesize that there is also dark matter in the universe. So there's two types of non-relativistic matter in the universe today, it appears. I mean, it's embarrassing to have to say this, but it appears that to fit the data, I have to tell you, there are many lines of evidence that suggest that this is true. So the non-relativistic matter in the universe today comes in two forms. There's baryonic matter, which is what cosmologists call basically all the atoms in the periodic table. Okay, this is you and me and the stuff you see and stars and so forth. But then there's also dark matter, and there's about five times as much of this as there is of this. Okay. And dark matter, so far we only see its gravitational effect. We apparently see its gravitational effect consistently in many different cosmological observations, including this one. We can't account for those observations without invoking its presence. But embarrassingly, that's the only way we see it at the moment. We don't see, so apparently it has essentially no interactions with photons, or only very ultra-weak interactions, not ultra-weak, but let's say weak scale interactions with the particles of the Standard Model. So, in the early universe, imagine some tiny little perturbation in the dark matter density. Okay, so the dark matter at some point in space, so this is the density of dark matter as a function of spatial position. So at this point in space and this point, the dark matter density is a little bit higher than everywhere else, 10 to the minus 5 higher here. At these points, it's 10 to the minus 5 times. If this is the average density, this is the average density plus 10 to the minus 5. This is the average density minus 10 to the minus 5. So tiny little fluctuations of the same order as the fluctuations in this figure. Okay, so then on top of that dark matter, there's also the ordinary photons and baryons that you and I consist of. And so just imagine that in the early universe, those photons and baryons are some uniform fluid. But now, since the dark matter is a little bit denser here than here, the gravitational force is a little bit stronger here. So this is a little potential well, and this is a little peak in the gravitational potential. So the first thing that these atoms want to do is they want to fall in to this potential well. But remember, they're not atoms yet. They're electrons and protons. So they get pulled in by the gravity of this peak in the dark matter density. But they're so tightly coupled to the photons. They're still free electrons and free protons. They're charged particles. They're so tightly coupled to the photons, they pull the photons in with them. So the photons and protons and electrons fall. The first thing they do is fall onto this well. But then photons do not like to be pulled in. Photons like to be free. They have a huge pressure relative to their density. They're a gas of relativistic particles. So you try to compress them. Eventually, they get angry. They rebel. Their pressure forces that you overdo it. You always overdo it, you know, with these things. And so you overdo it. Eventually, the photons get frustrated. They get pressurized. Their pressure gets too high. They blow the stuff back out. But then they overdo it as well. They calm down a little bit, and the gravity pulls you back in. And so there's an oscillation that takes place. You get a standing wave here where first the guys fall in, then pressure drives them back out, then gravity pulls them back in. So on every length scale, there's an oscillation that takes place. But on shorter length scales, the oscillation takes place at a frequency that's set by the speed of sound in this fluid, which is basically a constant as a function of scale. So shorter length scales, oscillations happen faster. Longer length scales, this oscillation takes a longer time to happen. One period takes a longer time. So there is some special length scale that between the Big Bang and the moment when the CMB was released, its oscillation frequency was just right so that it had time to compress exactly one time. Okay? That's the first peak in the CMB. That's what that length scale is. Okay? So this as you go to higher and higher L, higher and higher spherical harmonics, you're talking about smaller and smaller angle fluctuations on the CMB. So smaller and smaller length scales, that you're looking at on the surface of the CMB. This is the mode in the early universe that had time to compress just once. This is the mode in the early universe that had time to compress and rarefy just once. This guy had time to compress, rarefy, and recompress. Okay, so these are the so-called acoustic oscillations or Sakharov oscillations in the early universe. They at this point give us very detailed confirmation that we know what we're doing. On the other hand, they give us very detailed confirmation that we have to invoke dark matter and dark energy in the early universe, which are deeply embarrassing to all working cosmologists because they're really just fudge factors at the moment that we don't understand where they come from. Finally, we think that the detailed structure of the statistics of the CMB, again, are telling us about ultra-early times, but the exact story remains to be unraveled. Okay, maybe I'll stop there.